Want to expand the influence of design? Pragmatic Institute offers interactive, actionable courses for designers who are looking to contribute more strategically in their organizations. Explore our offerings such as Business Strategy and Design and Influence Through Storytelling at pragmaticinstitute.com/design.
And welcome to Design Chats, a podcast from Pragmatic Institute, where we sit down with design leaders, practitioners, and alumni to discuss how to grow the strategic impact of design. I am Rebecca Calajaris, Vice President of Marketing and Product Strategy at Pragmatic Institute. Today, we are doing one of my very favorite type of podcasts, which is when we talk to practitioners and we hear from them real stories about what's working, about what's not, how they are building their teams, their divisions, their function at organizations. And today I'm very excited to introduce Jose Coronado, Head of Design Operations at JPMorgan Chase & Co. And Jose leads design ops globally for the corporate and investment bank. So welcome to Design Chats, Jose. We are extremely excited to have you.
Thank you for the invitation. Really excited to be here and share some stories with your audience.
Excellent. All right. Let's start about with your story, right? What was your journey into design and what kind of sparked your passion?
Well, I do a summarized version, but I'm going to share a couple of tidbits. So my background is in industrial design. So as an industrial designer, I work in packaging, in consumer products, in furniture. And when I came to grad school, I asked my advisor, what should I start doing? And he asked me, what do you want to do? Which is quite different in terms of contrast of the educational system in Colombia, where I'm originally from, and the educational system in the U.S., and also like a graduate program where you basically design the program yourself. So I started doing what I was doing, packaging, furniture, and consumer electronics. And then when I got into consumer electronics, I discovered this thing called soft design or software design. And I never looked back. So I've been in digital, in the web, and in everything that deals with software interfaces throughout my entire career. When I left grad school, I basically got my bearings in design in enterprise technology. So the first half of my career, complex problems, messy problems, not sexy problems to deal with. And that's basically how I got into design leadership as well. Growing teams, helping teams, developing a strategic impact or demonstrating the strategic impact that we could have. And my mid-career transition was with management consulting. So companies like Accenture and McKinsey that gave me the opportunity to broaden my perspective, not just on enterprise tech, but on pharma, on insurance, on financial services, on venture capital, many, many different arenas. And now the current chapter of my career is with one of the largest financial institutions in the world.
Great. What about design ops? Like, what made you think, you know, what kind of moved from being a designer to thinking about it, the operational side of it? What does design ops mean to you, and what made you so excited to kind of focus there?
Well, I think, and I talk publicly and in private forums about these. Basically, as a design leader, I had to do it all. Mm-hmm. I had to worry about hiring, career progression, career architecture for designers, templates, processes, tools for my team, deal with HR in compensation, in promotion paths, on basically anything that deal with people, processes, and infrastructure. I have to do it as a design leader because 10 years ago, or even 5 years ago, we didn't know what design operations was. So I was already doing a big portion of my time was invested in the operationalization of the team. And basically, when I got called by JP Morgan, they said, you know, we need somebody that can help us build a design operations practice. Are you interested? And I said, absolutely. And basically, the way I define design operations for our team, and basically as I speak publicly about these, design operations, we basically create the programs, the products, the services that the designers need to be effective and engage in their everyday work. So I mentioned the hiring process, onboarding, career and professional development, the junior designer program, which we have, which is called the design development program for people with 0 years of experience in industry. And one important aspect, and probably that's why we ended up connecting with Pragmatic, anything that deals with professional development and enhancing our skills as designers. One of our biggest opportunities in terms of professional growth deals with enabling designers to become better storytellers, to be able to make the connection between design and the business impact that we generate. So those are some of the things that get me excited every day in terms of the type of work that my team does and how we are basically empowering and enabling designers to have a higher impact in the organization.
It's really an amplification of what you were doing with your design teams before, right? Because you're doing it across the organization and what you're creating is sort of a scaffolding that enables these designers and the design function to really mature and progress in JP Morgan, which I think must be extraordinarily exciting.
Yeah, and I think I would go beyond what you just mentioned. It's not just the amplification of what I was doing as a design leader, but it's actually the focus of exclusively having a team dedicated to concentrate on these important aspects of running the design team as a business and giving the time back to the design leadership of the team to focus on developing the relationships across with their partners in product and technology to showcase the outcomes and the business result that the team is delivering, rather than, you know, creating a position or dealing with the human capital management system of the organization or some things that are important, but that we can help them with from a design operations perspective, so they can actually concentrate on relationships and also developing their people.
That's powerful, right? That's powerful. It's a great clarification on sort of how this is more of a governance role, for lack. It's because it is a distinct role and it's very focused in this area. It really then sort of unleashes the team leaders to focus on those pieces and the relationships within and across. That's powerful.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And as you've built out that sort of design operations function at JP Morgan, how have you seen the practice mature and evolve?
Well, I'm going to be vulnerable and recognize failure. My year one, I was brand new to the organization. I had only one partner in crime to work with, so we were a team of two. And a lot of the issues that we identified were considered design operations issues. So this is a Jose problem. This is a design ops problem. And I didn't take a page from our product management counterparts. They are very good and very skilled at saying no to things. So I committed to too many things and I didn't deliver on almost any of the things that I committed to. So that was a very tough year for a person like me, for a person who's used to always performing at the highest level, not leaving anything behind, not dropping any ball. And actually somebody, now that I mentioned balls, somebody mentioned, make sure that the balls you drop are the rubber ones, not the glass ones. So basically after the tough lessons learned on year one and that less than a stellar year for us, I basically developed two principles that I repeat a lot and my team knows them. Make assumptions explicit. Do not assume that something is going to happen or somebody will do something that you need. Make sure that that actually takes place. So that's the first principle that I hone in time and time again. And the second principle, and probably the most important one, is like, let's right size our commitment. If we're going to commit to something, let's make sure that we are confident that it will be completed or delivered or done within the time frame and with the capacity that we have. And if somebody in the design leadership team comes or there's a big need inside the design team that bubbles up in the priority list, that we're absolutely explicit about saying, you want that to happen, then this other thing needs to give away or be demoted in the time frame, or instead of completing X, we're going to do Y because we don't have the capacity to do the whole thing. So those are two of the biggest lessons I learned, and I basically keep them as a guiding principle for the people in my team. You asked me about the maturity of the team, and I'm going to then tell you about it. So at the beginning, we were like a kiddie soccer team. We were very few, and there were many problems and many fires, and we were all pursuing the ball. Right now, I have a team of, I believe it's about 23 people. So we have now focus areas. I have a person who leads my people operations practice, so everything that deals with onboarding, recruiting, professional development, learning, growth, culture, and infrastructure falls under that category. And I am very lucky to have a very, very strong team of different levels of skills and seniority, but people are now focused on key areas. So not everybody has to go chasing the ball. And then the other half of my team is the design program management practice, which is basically at the portfolio level. We're able to align ourselves with the design leads and their portfolio, and we are able to give basically a picture of the people, the mini roadmaps for the year, the composition of the portfolio by program and by product, but we don't go to the product team level or the feature team level. We stay a little bit above that. And with those two areas of practice, we are basically able to give the design leadership team and the designers roughly about anywhere between 15% to 20% time back. Mm-hmm. So they can concentrate on their actual work and the relationships that they have to build rather than concentrating on the operations aspect of the team.
That's a lot of time back.
Yep, absolutely.
So one of the things that you've spoken a lot about throughout your career in lots of different places is design leadership. And one of the things here at Pragmatic that we're really interested is sort of how to help and how can design leaders help practitioners successfully navigate business challenges, right? It's a lot more than just design challenges that we deal with. And I would love to get your thoughts on that.
Yeah, so I think there's a couple of frameworks that I use. Well, before I get into the frameworks, I think it is a very important role of a design leader, whether you're a new manager or you're an established leader, to understand where are the areas of focus and where are you investing your time. If you are a frontline manager, so you just became a manager or you have been a frontline manager for a while, a lot of your time is focused on the people and the craft. You're mentoring, you're coaching, you're ensuring that there's quality in the work that you do. And when you are a leader of leaders, you have people in your team, in your leadership team, that are going to focus on the people and the craft. Your focus has to shift into business results and improvements and efficiency and effectiveness of your team. And that's where like the time back to the design leaders to develop the strengthen the relationships with their peers in the design team and with their counterparts in product, technology, and business area. So this framework that I just described was created by Peter Merholtz, the co-author of the Or Design for Design Org. And the other framework that I use is created by a British designer. His name is Jason Mesut, that basically has a different set of dimensions in the, let's call them the wine wheel. But basically, it gives you the opportunity to reflect as a design leader, where am I investing my time? So, for example, for me, a lot of my time is invested towards the team, towards the inside, because my primary stakeholder, my primary beneficiary of the products and services that my team creates is the design team. However, I balance that with reaching out to the other design teams in the organization, creating a forum for design operations leaders across the bank to make sure that we compare notes, share things that we have solved and not have to recreate the wheel, whether it's around professional development or technology and infrastructure or tools, so we can all leverage the joint forces rather than each one of us doing things in duplicate or triplicate.
I think the role of the leader sort of shifting as they get more mature makes a lot of sense, and having those frameworks to work off of.
Yeah. And I'm going to add one more thing, and I briefly mentioned it at the beginning. We have the fiduciary duty to our practice as designers to ensure that we are intentionally creating professional development opportunities for junior designers. When I mentioned junior designers, and I have seen job descriptions that said junior designer needed 5 years of experience, a stellar portfolio required. That's not a junior designer description. So that's why in the bank this year, we launched the design development program, initially only in our line of business. And for 2023, we have it firm-wide design development program, where the definition is 0 years of experience, a school or bootcamp portfolio required. So we want to make sure that we bring people to the design team with different backgrounds, different levels of experience, different type of education. And we create learning program where they are going to be doing about 80% of the work in product and about 20% of their work in learning. So that way we create also the conditions for our senior designers to have the ability to mentor, to coach, to guide, and they grow themselves as well if they're interested into the leadership path or continue their technical growth with some teaching and coaching and mentoring opportunities with the junior designers in the team.
Well, and that kind of flexibility, I think, is something that you bring to a lot of the aspects of design. One of the other areas that you talk about flexibility is flexible recognition, right? So let's dig a little bit into that.
So a few years ago, I ran into an article published by Katie Deal. And basically in that article, she mentions that people speak different languages, different language of recognition. So if you have only one way in which you recognize your team, then those people that speak a different language or expect a different type of recognition will not feel valued or recognized. So the most visible way of recognizing somebody is with title and compensation. So that's one thing. But some people appreciate the time that you invest in them. So, for example, in my case, my one-on-ones with the people in my team are super, super important. And I may move them around if I have to, but I will not like just cancel on them. That's time that for me, it's important to invest in the team. If you have some people that feel recognized when they are empowered and they have autonomy, so maybe they need a project that they can do by themselves with certain deadlines, and you only check in for progress and making sure that there are roadblocks that you can help them with. Other people appreciate private or public recognition, a thank you note or a thank you in your team meeting or in a global forum. And other people appreciate visibility. So it's not just you as the head of a particular practice in the team presenting to design leadership, but maybe it's people in your team presenting their work or their outcomes to the design leadership team. So those are just a few examples of ways in which we have to be flexible in the way, flexible and emotionally intelligent in the way in which we recognize the people in our team.
I can reflect on my own team and tell you there are those who love to present their work and those who would, you know, consider that some form of punishment. And I think it's interesting, as one aspect as you were talking was that it's not just helping me understand what kind of recognition they need, but I think there's probably an element of it of helping the organization see that value doesn't come from just one type of recognition either, right? That sometimes if someone always presenting their work, there could be a feeling in the rest of the organization that that person must be a better performer or more valued than someone else who doesn't like or doesn't react to that same kind of recognition.
Yeah, so that's why I think one of the calls to action from Katie in her article is about be open with your team. Ask them if they have a person in the team, how would you recognize them? And many times they will tell you in that reflection the way they would like themselves to be recognized. Mm-hmm. So having an open conversation and making sure that you understand the language that they are expecting from you in terms of recognition. So I think it doesn't take much of an effort in your part. It's just making sure that you invest a little bit of time into finding that out.
That's a great point. All right. I always enjoy hearing you talk about design. I think something that may surprise people, right, or to some, is sort of what kind of role design can play in financial services. And it's such a fast-moving space. But I think, and I know you see just a ton of impact design can have in there. So let's explore that a little bit.
So I think one interesting factor. So this year, we have been involved directly in about 10 different conferences. In the first conference, first live event that we were involved in London, the first question that many attendees were asking is like, what is JP Morgan doing in a design conference? So what that basically tells us is that we need to elevate our profile and be more visible and intentional about our presence in the design industry, because people don't know or don't think that there's almost 2,000 designers in a place like JP Morgan. So I think it is first about expanding our presence in industry, in conferences, in trade magazines and articles and podcasts like this one. And also defining what type of designer is successful in an organization like ours. So we have consumer experience, we have employee experience, we have enterprise experience. And basically that gives you almost like all of the above. If you're a consumer designer, there's a place for you. If you're focused on people experience, there's a place for you. If you're focused on complex, messy, not sexy problems, there's also a place for you in an organization like ours. So I think it is very important for us to be intentional about how we are perceived from the design industry and basically from the people in design. And I think in terms of the opportunity, oh my goodness, talking about business value and business impact, you know, you could be involved in programs and products that are used by millions of people, like the consumer mobile app, or you could be involved in programs that are moving millions or protecting millions of dollars in money in the enterprise side of the house. And many of our products are award-winning products. And we are continuously investing in design and design people. So the opportunities are just prime for anybody who would like to join us.
How would you consider JP Morgan's design sort of function and focus compared to others in the financial services industry?
That is a good question that I'm not so prepared to answer because I am new to financial services.
That's fair. No.
Having said that, I can tell you that, for example, for our team, one of the key pieces of criteria when we're looking at potential candidates is complex application experience. And I say complex application experience is not financial services. It's complex application experience, enterprise technology, management consulting. And then it would be great if you have some financial services experience. But when you look at that criteria, you are opening yourself to be more receptive to people who are different than you, who don't have the experience that you have, but that have a lot of experience that brings to the table, to an enterprise, business-to-business team like ours, a lot of the skills that are needed to navigate a complex problem, navigate a complex organization, be able to articulate the value of your design, persuade the stakeholders, and be able to have a lot of influence and impact in the programs that you are involved in.
That's a great question. I mean, I think that's another great area, right? What other things can designers do when they want to have that bigger impact? I think we see a lot of people who love design and maybe sometimes are a little frustrated that they don't feel like they have the opportunity to have the impact. They see the opportunities where they could have impact, but maybe aren't able to capitalize them or kind of get permission to play in those areas.
Yeah. So I think I have a couple of perspectives. One is around how we claim to be the champions of empathy about the people that use our products, but we are very bad about being empathetic to one another in our design industry. And you see social media threads, people with different opinions or diverging opinions, and then going at each other. And we're also pretty bad about being empathetic to our product, technology, and business partners. And we say that person doesn't get it, that person is an idiot or something like that. And we don't pause for a minute to think or to reflect or to ask them, what is their motivation? What is their underlying agency? Why are they making certain decisions that you may not disagree with? And just by simply asking them questions, you may uncover that they're under pressure by their head of business side, or that there's issues with critical clients that they need to resolve, and that's why they are not willing to compromise with you as a designer. So we have to actually use the same tools that we use to solve problems to actually create a strong relationships with our partners in product and technology. And I think many times we don't need to wait. We don't have to wait to be invited. We have to invite ourselves into the conversation. And sometimes that takes the shape of applying the same design methods to solve, create a new business model, help a team set up their strategic plan for the year that's coming up. And we're basically using the same methods, brainstorming, idea, affinity diagramming, prioritization, and things like that. It's exactly the same thing. We just applying it to a business context. And that's when the business partners and the product partners begin seeing us with a different lens. So it's about creating those opportunities or finding those people who are friendlier to design or more open to design, and then ensuring that we can actually partner strongly and effectively with them, both in terms of design, as well as in terms of those areas that are of concern to them, where maybe design methodologies and techniques can help them.
Great advice. Speaking of great advice, Jose, you've given lots of great advice and a lot of great insights over the last half hour or so. And we talked a lot about a lot of different things. If you were going to have our listeners do two things differently tomorrow, based on what we talked about today, where would you focus them?
I think if you raise the flag or if you raise the argument that you want to have greater business impact, I think you have to understand how the company makes money and how the company spends money. For example, a company like ours publishes a very detailed quarterly report on the state of the business. I have actually have candidates tell me, Jose, I observed this in the report and they asked me a question about it. That actually shows curiosity, wanting to understand the business, and also trying to determine how their role is going to have a potential impact in that area. And it could take a half an hour to read sometimes these detailed reports or the CEO letter to the investors, to the stakeholders, to the shareholders. And you would find incredible amount of information that you can leverage, and you can map your actual work to that level of impact. You can connect it to the strategic priorities of the organization. And I think that is an important way in which many times we get so distracted with our craft and our processes that we forget to just take a step back, look a little bit higher up, and view how our craft and our work, how the things that we're doing actually have that level of impact. And that's one way in which we are trying to instill the evolution of our designers to grow in terms of supplementing their craft with their understanding of the business so they can articulate the business impact that they're having.
Fantastic advice, Jose. And if listeners want to follow your work and learn more about your perspectives, learn more about what you're doing, where would you send them?
I'm very active in LinkedIn and Twitter. So Jose Coronado in LinkedIn and jcoronado1 in Twitter.
Excellent. Jose, it has been a pleasure. Thank you so much for taking the time to lend us your expertise.
I really appreciate the invitation, and I hope that the listeners are able to walk away with something that resonates with them or a nugget or two that they can apply in their work.
Absolutely. All right. That does it for today's episode. And thank you for everyone for listening. If you're looking to learn more about contributing strategically, driving value and building influence, not only check out Jose's LinkedIn and Twitter, but be sure to check out pragmaticinstitute.com/design. Thank you.